the Los Angeles Times, this is The Envelope, the podcast, your ultimate guide to award season.
We're your hosts. I'm Mark Olson.
And I'm Yvonne Villarreal.
Every week, this podcast showcases key voices across both film and TV.
And today, we're so excited to have Journey Smollett as a guest on our show. She recently played Letty Lewis in HBO's sci-fi drama Lovecraft Country. The show takes place in 1950s Jim Crow America, and I spoke with Journey about what this series means to her.
I see the conversations that have come from Lovecraft. That's the true joy in being an artist, right? To feel that you're part of something that's mighty, to feel that the work, it's impacting people in a way that is deep and meaningful and creating conversations.
That interview is coming up in just a couple of minutes.
I'm excited to hear that talk with Journey, Yvonne. But first, let's turn things over to our critic, Glenn, for Glenn Whip's Awards Minute.
I mentioned in another podcast segment that, I mean, this award season, everyone's stuck inside their homes watching awards contenders on their computers. There are still some screenings for movies. And I tried to go to one of these 2 or 3 weeks ago. There was a great Amazon Prime movie called Sound of Metal, which is now on the site. But I wanted to get out. I'm going crazy. So I drove up to the City of Industry to a drive-in theater just to see what's going on with these drive-in screenings. So I drive up the 605. I get off on Valley Boulevard. I drive past 24 taco trucks, the world's saddest and seediest strip club. I made a left there. And then I go up to the Vineland Drive-In Theater where they're having a guild screening for guild, you know, Screen Actors Guild voters of Sound of Metal. Except the movie was supposed to start at 7, but the drive-in had just kind of changed the start time. So it started at 8:45 instead of 7, which meant that myself and the 5 other people, they were either Academy members or Guild members who had driven to the City of Industry, had to wait 2 hours, which none of us did. I rolled down my window to somebody and we were like, yeah, there was that taco truck down the street. I'll see you there. And the tacos were good. And I saw Sound of Metal at home on my laptop. So that's this award season right now.
Well, we let you go over that minute, but it was just because I think we just all wanted to know if you did end up getting those tacos, and I'm glad you did. But yeah, I haven't ventured to a drive-in screening, and there have been a few on the TV side, so maybe I'll add it to my list. Mark, have you been to one?
You know, I actually have been to a drive-in screening. I was at the local premiere of the movie Nomadland, directed by Chloe Zhao, and starring Frances McDormand, and it's about these sort of self-styled nomads in the contemporary American West. And some of the people who were in the movie, that the world the movie is about, were actually at the screening with some of their kind of like customized camper vans. And it kind of really did bring the movie to life. But that's something I think we're going to be talking about more as the season moves along. So we'll save that for another time.
This episode of the Envelope Podcast is sponsored by Apple TV Plus, presenting the animated film Wolfwalkers. A young apprentice hunter journeys to Ireland with her father to help wipe out the last wolf pack. Everything changes when she befriends a free-spirited girl from a mysterious tribe, rumored to transform into wolves by night. Go to fyc.appletvplus.com for more.
So now let's get to your conversation with Journey. Yvonne, what stood out for you about this conversation?
You know, something we talked about is how timely this series would be in any year. But the fact that it came out, you know, after the protests that we saw, it just really resonated on a different level. And I could really tell that this particular role means a lot to her, in part because she shares a lot of her own family history and really drew on those personal experiences in playing Letty.
Well, I'm looking forward to giving it a listen. Let's go to your interview with Journey Smollett.
Journey, thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
How many podcasts have you done in quarantine, Journey?
We've done a whole promo tour in quarantine. Okay. Like, I mean, I've presented at awards in quarantine. I've done late night TV shows in quarantine, man. All honestly, the biggest achievement is that I did it all without childcare. I'm most proud of that.
It's amazing. Well, I was going to say, I mean, has this year made you more cynical or hopeful? How are you feeling about 2021? Like, I don't know how to feel about her yet. Like, I'm trying to practice gratitude because 2020 has been a lot, and I'm trying to be hopeful about what's to come. How are you feeling?
Okay, so interestingly enough, I think when it all kind of started to settle in, like March, April, I went through a real low point. I mean, real depression set in for me. I became very cynical for a short period of time, I have to say. And then kind of slapped myself and woke myself up out of it. You know, James Baldwin famously talks about, you know, he can't be a pessimist, you know, because we're alive, you know. And I've always interpreted that to mean that there is such responsibility and duty and blessing to being alive, to having breath, when so many people say they can't breathe or have lost their breath. How dare I sit and sit in my sorrow? You know, how dare I? It would be such a disservice to the gifts I've been given, the life I've been given. It'd be like a smack in God's face, you know? And so that's what I've realized. And it's the struggle, because you have good days and you have not so good days. You know, I give myself the space to feel what I feel, but there's always like, all right, you got to work through it. All right, well, what is it? Is it playing the guitar, picking the guitar up? Is it going to a protest rally? Is it playing with the Picasso blocks with my son? Is it spending time with my sister? Or, you know, like, what is it that's feeding my soul right now? And then what can I do actually to feed someone else's soul?
Well, what's feeding my soul right now is, like, I feel like I've dedicated my life to watching Christmas movies. This weekend, I just dove right in. I just need to feel like the cuddly warmth of something right now.
Good for you. You should.
Thank you. And where are you calling us from? You're calling us from Australia. Tell me what you're doing there.
So I'm here in Australia, got through the 14-day quarantine period successfully, and shooting Spiderhead here with Chris Hemsworth and Miles Teller, Joe Kosinski's next film for Netflix. We're in it.
How has it been so far?
Oh, man. Well, one, you know, it's such a great group of guys I'm working with. So incredibly talented. Everyone brings such different skill sets to it. It's a wacky, crazy, fun, out-of-the-box movie we're making. I can't entirely describe what it's about, but it's wacky and wild and very meaningful too, though. So yeah, I mean, I'm loving being back on set. You know, I missed it so much. It's definitely different shooting in COVID times, but I'm just loving being back in it, stretching my muscles and getting everything activated again.
Well, I want to talk with you about Lovecraft Country. The series is not necessarily based on an H.P. Lovecraft book, but rather the 2016 dark fantasy horror novel by Matt Ruff. How much did you know about either of their works before being cast in the series?
I was familiar enough with Lovecraft's work of like, oh, I knew he was master of horror, master of terror, you know. The book by Matt Ruff, though, I was not aware of until Misha Green told me she was going to do this with J.J. Abrams and Jordan Peele. It wasn't until she sent me the pilot. Like, she went off for a few weeks and was like, okay, I really got to go and write this thing. that they're, you know, expecting me to have by now. And I mean, maybe even 3 weeks later, she was done. That's just how genius she is. And she just kind of casually sent me the pilot for it. And I read it. I was just blown away instantly by it and felt such a calling inside of me that I had to be a part of it, that I had to play Letty. That, you know, it's one of those moments as an actor where you just feel like, oh no, I was born to play this character. I mean, she is in my body. She's in my DNA. And so then I went back and read Matt Ruff's book because I didn't know how much campaigning I was going to have to do for the role with Misha, with HBO, with JJ, with all, you know, the whole crew. And so I was like, you know what? Let me do what I do. My process is you do research and you prepare. And I didn't know what she'd have me do. And I needed to be as prepared in order to fight for it. So that's when I read Matt Ruff's book, was actually after reading the pilot. And so I read it through that lens, through that perspective. You know, it was interesting to see what she changed. You know, Diana was actually a boy in the book and Christina was a man. And, you know, it's interesting to see how she made just really clever changes and tweaks and then combined certain things. And yeah, I just became obsessed with it then.
Well, I want to talk more about teaming back up again with Misha, because for those that didn't watch Underground, you know, it was this historical drama which told the story of a group of enslaved people who sort of escaped their plantation in antebellum Georgia through the Underground Railroad. And in Lovecraft Country, I mean, it also tackles historical horrors, but they are sort of blended with supernatural elements. What has sort of struck you about Misha's work? I mean, Lovecraft feels like a piece out of time and sort of not bound by rules, like the way she sort of layers like James Baldwin's speech or the music that accompanies some of the scenes are really brilliant. Did you ever just like text her or call her and say like, where did this come from in your mind? Like, how did you do this? Because watching it, I'm like, where did this come from? What she worked through this, it's pretty amazing.
If you watch Underground, you'll see flashes and elements of her creativity that lay over into Lovecraft. You know, the way she uses music, contemporary music, to tell a narrative, to really take these historical narratives off the museum wall, you know, and place them right in our laps and make them very relatable. You know, those were elements that she was playing with in Underground. One thing I know about working with Misha is she thrives on the unexpected. She thrives on the surprise elements, right? And she is not interested in telling stories in a traditional way. And that's what excites me. You know, the artist in me responds to that in her. You know, well, let's dig deeper. How imaginative can we be? How much can we expand our imagination? You know, how innovative can we be? Okay, if this is what we think the answer is, how can we challenge that? You know, and she and I are always challenging each other. That's the thing. When we initially were working with each other on Underground, we talk about this all the time, about how much we initially disliked each other. On the pilot of Underground, I remember coming home being like, what did I do? How did I sign this contract to work with this woman? I mean, this is, how do I get out? Like, I'm stuck for years with this woman. And she and I just fought a lot for a number of reasons. But what we've since learned is we needed to, at that time, just learn each other's love language. We were essentially after the same target, trying to achieve the same goal. And that was to stretch and grow and challenge and push ourselves and break genres, right? So people wanted to say Underground was a slave drama. Actually, it's a prison break show, you know, and it's about superheroes. That's the story we're telling in our minds, you know? It's about men and women who were enslaved, who fought against the system, right? So you think we're telling one story, but actually, no, we are trying to tell a totally different thing. And so that's where I'm like, okay, I get on the train with her. She's just this genre-bending force. And that's what excites me, because as an artist who's both Black and female, you know, I sit at the intersection of multiple identities and have been quite frustrated throughout my career that there are stories I'd like to be able to tell, or emotions I'd like to be able to express, colors I'd like to play with. And I feel like I've very much so found a creative partner in her, in which she writes stories that I want to be a part of.
The thing about Lovecraft, the tragic thing about Lovecraft, is the themes that it explores would have relevance in any year. But with its release this year, after a summer of protests and renewed focus on racial injustice, there was this added layer of significance, you know, because it really unpacks how historical trauma and personal trauma are linked together. So for you, while promoting the series or even watching the masses consume it, how did you process your own feelings about the Black experience in America? Like, how did this series coming out now help you reflect on what's going on?
This is what I know. We tell a story in episode 8 about Bobo, Emmett Till, being tragically murdered. Emmett Till is Trayvon Martin, okay? We as a society suffer from cultural amnesia. We forget our past. And it is the very reason why we are repeating it, okay? Brother Floyd or Breonna Taylor or, you know, the siblings that we have lost, that we continue to lose, unfortunately fall in line with the historical suffering that we as a people have witnessed for generations, right? We have inherited a lineage of trauma. We have inherited a lineage of terror. Black safety is one of the most terrifying themes and stories you can tell, right? And so if you tell a story like Lovecraft Country, yes, placing it right in the time in 2020 when, you know, there is so much social unrest, yes, it is quite explosive. However, it is very true that there is no time since 1619 that Lovecraft Country would not be relevant. You understand? And so it's so hard for me to really engage in this notion that, oh, wow, Lovecraft is so timely. And, you know, because I just challenge the notion of that, you know, tell me when it wouldn't be timely. That's the grief. That's the sorrow. That is the real unfortunate truth that we as a nation have to face, that we will continue to have to tell these stories, and these stories will continue to be relevant and current, quote unquote, until we as a nation heal from the systemic racism that is embedded in our society. When we talk about Letty buying a house in an all-white neighborhood and quote-unquote pioneering, and you talk about redlining, and in Chicago or across the North and South, not just the South, but the North as well, Black folks were systemically denied the right to purchase homes, right? Couldn't get loans. Banks would not give them a loan, even if they qualified for it, even if they had the down payment or the funds. They couldn't buy into certain neighborhoods. We are talking about the system excluding us from generational wealth. How am I supposed to inherit any sort of generational wealth from my grandmother or from my folks when they weren't able to buy into the pot? You see what I'm saying? And so when we talk about having equal opportunity or equal access for Black or brown folks, the playing field's not level because we've inherited this systemic racism. So yeah, it's quite deep. But for me as an artist, what is so satisfying is that I see the conversations that have come from Lovecraft. That's the true joy in being an artist, right? To feel that you're part of something that's mighty, to feel that the work it's impacting people in a way that is deep and meaningful and creating conversations. But I think we have to, I just think we got to confront it.
This episode of the Envelope Podcast is sponsored by Apple TV Plus, presenting the animated film Wolfwalkers. A young apprentice hunter journeys to Ireland with her father to help wipe out the last wolf pack. Everything changes when she befriends a free-spirited girl from a mysterious tribe, rumored to transform into wolves by night. Go to fyc.appletvplus.com for more.
You've spoken a lot about how you thought about your grandmother, who you never met, in playing this part, which must have been a very powerful experience. Like, talk me through what that felt like.
My grandmother was nicknamed Showtime, and she was the first Black Miss Galveston, Texas. And so she was a beauty queen, you know, and I grew up hearing stories of this beauty queen who loved to entertain and host parties at her small house and could sit down and play poker with the best of them and loved a good Jack and Coke and was quite a woman who was ahead of her times. She raised four children as a single mother in the 1950s in the South, in New Orleans. Think about that. You know, she dealt with whispers and comments and trying to shame her, right? So I grew up hearing about how my grandmother navigated this world of being both Black and female and being a single working mother. She cleaned the homes of white folks, which is something Letty says she'll never do, right? Very ambitious. And yeah, I never got the chance to meet her. She passed away when my mother was pregnant with my oldest brother, but her spirit was palpable in my household.
Well, through the years, you've talked a lot about the influence your mom, Janet, had on you and what her activism had on your life and career. So I'm sort of curious, like, what did your mother think of this series, which is a piece of protest art in itself?
Here's the thing. My mother is an activist and through and through is her, you know, like she met my dad in the 70s working with Angela Davis. So this is the woman that raised me, right? Oh my gosh, she loves Lovecraft. I mean, you can't get her to shut up about it. I mean, it's, she loves everybody in it. I took the first three episodes to her to show it to her, maybe like a few weeks before it aired when HBO sent it to me, and she ate it up. Now, she's not a horror fan. This is not her genre. And she's so honest with me. There are for sure moments that I've done work. She'll be honest and be like, no, booby. That wasn't it. She's my toughest critic, but also my biggest cheerleader, which is quite beautiful. She was my first acting coach, you know. So she knows my instrument inside and out and still feels like, you know, she always got something to tell me. But with Lovecraft, now she loves it. She's incredibly moved by it, which meant a lot to me.
Because there was a period when you wanted to quit acting, right? And sort of lean into this activist role. Like, what helped you see that you don't have to sacrifice one for the other, that there can be power in art?
Right. That you know, the goal is that you can create this radical art that can spark the flame in others, right? It was a trip to South Africa when I was 20 years old with, you know, the artists who were also activists like Samuel Jackson and LaTanya Richardson and Deborah and Carlos Santana and Alfre Woodard. You know, these were all artists who were taking a delegation to South Africa. And they called me and said, listen, we're going to take you with us. And they paid my whole way for me to go on this trip. And on that trip, it changed my life, man. You know, I saw while we were there and we were doing real tangible work, it was real tangible work that I saw on the ground changing people's lives. But what occurred to me is that it was art that got us there. And how dare I, if I've been gifted with the ability to be an artist, how dare I not use this gift? And so on my way back when I landed back in the States 2 weeks later, I stayed in New York and was sent the script of The Great Debaters, the film Denzel Washington directed and starred in. And that, yeah, that was another project that then changed my life, right? You know, it made me fall in love again with the craft because when you work with Denzel Washington, it is like taking a masterclass. And so I learned so much about the craft, you know, and realized what I didn't love about what I did was the business side of it. There are moments when you're dealing with all the other bullshit of this industry that you have to remember that's separate. You must endure that in order to just get on set to do what you love. But you don't need approval to do what you love. I can do what I love right here in this motherfucking room, okay? I can, whatever I desire to do is what we'll do. And so I've really been working on myself of like taking the power away from this business side of it. You know, not asking for approval to create art. You don't. We can go put on a play right here on this balcony if we wanted to, you know? No one has to give you the approval to create your art. I could pick up my phone and create a short film. You know, like, I can do whatever I want. What do I want to do? And, you know, as actors, sometimes we really downplay what we do. Society does it. Society paints this picture like actors are vain. All we want is fame. The saying, people are always like, well, yeah, but it's not rocket science, you know? Or they'll be like, well, can you really believe him? Because he is an actor, so he's good at lying. It's actually not true. Actors, I suck at lying. I'm an awful liar. I gotta believe what I'm saying, okay? Like, it's not lying what I'm doing. I gotta believe it. I gotta go to a place in my imagination where I believe I'm this fucking woman.
You alluded to this, you know, working with Denzel. You've worked with some of the greats, like Miss Cicely Tyson, Alfre Woodard, Denzel. How do you even process working alongside these sorts of heavyweights? And what did it teach you about acting?
Oh, my goodness. I know. I don't think about it often until asked. But it is true. I have been quite blessed. My very first film was directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And Robin Williams, I mean, I was a kid, I was a baby, but there are things that I remember about working with Robin Williams where I was like, oh, he planted in me the like real essential techniques that you need for improv. Like he did, we improvised those scenes. I was a kid. And so, yeah, I've been quite blessed. And what, for me, that was my college. Those were my master classes. You know, I didn't go to college and have like a very traditional training. But for me, yeah, I have been quite blessed to work with the greats. You know, there's so many more that if I'm fortunate enough, I'll be able to continue to work with. But I learned from them. The stuff I learned from Denzel Washington on Great Debaters, man, is priceless, you know?
What's a note that Denzel gave you that has stuck with you, like about acting or your performance?
He would always just say, trust your instincts. He would say, less is more. Trust your instincts. Less is more. What I love about Denzel is he's so curious. He's so curious about art. And that's what a lot of the greats that I've learned. You know, Samuel Jackson, that man is so smart. He is so well-read. He reads everything. He watches everything. He listens to everything. And it's just, yeah, like they are just so hungry for art and being fed by art. There's no notion that they've arrived. You know, that's what I love. There is no arrival. It's the process, right? They're always trying to grow, always trying to get better, always trying to fill up their instrument. And I hope to be like that forever. I hope to always be curious, always be hungry, always want to get better. They have no real sense of like competition with other actors either, which I love. They're competing with themselves. You know, which so inspires me.
Well, something fans are curious and hungry for, but in a different capacity, is a second season of Lovecraft Country. Nothing has been officially announced yet. I know Misha's in talks. You know, she's not texting me about it, but maybe she's texting you. Is that something you would be open to, like coming back?
Oh, man. Are you kidding me? I mean, listen, it's up to the suits. But yeah, Letty, it's a dream character for me. One that cost me a lot. One that demanded I sacrifice a lot and just bring a lot to the altar, but I would jump at the chance if asked. Not only do they have to pick up a season two, they have to decide who's in season two. That's just the beast of TV. You just never know. You know, all that to say is I do not currently know. I would be honored and thrilled, and I hope it happens, and I hope I'm included in it, but I will, you know, accept and have peace with whatever happens.
Well, Journey, the whirlwind year for Hollywood and the world at large is not over. We're going to be having more of these. I predict we'll be having more of these sort of digital award ceremonies, stuff like this. How are you feeling about the way all this is set up? Like, usually you'd probably get to know people on other shows during this time as, you know, the promotions happen or red carpets. Is there someone you would have liked to meet if things were normal? Another series you've admired?
I am obsessed with I May Destroy You. She can do no wrong in my book. I mean, there's no wrong to be had by her. She could perform the Yellow Pages and I'd watch it. So, yeah, I'm kind of pissed that I haven't been able to meet her. But, you know, it's life. It's life. I did write HBO and be like, you guys are genius for having this show. Okay. And I like wrote a whole love letter to her through them. So I don't know if she's aware of it or not. But yeah, I'm definitely in love with her.
Stunning piece of work, for sure.
Stunning, stunning. Come on.
Well, we got to get you and Michaela to work on something together now.
Oh, man. I mean, I would die. I would die. I'm such a fangirl of hers. Yeah, she's just very gifted. Very gifted. And I'm curious to see what she does next, too.
I mean, Journey is not wrong. I May Destroy You was some of this year's best television. Mark, did you have a chance to watch that one?
Oh, yeah. That one I definitely made time to catch up on. And I mean, it's just such a singular piece of work. And you really feel like it couldn't have been done by anybody but Michaela.
I know. I'm so looking forward to see what comes from her in the future. I just want to see everything that she's behind. Because Chewing Gum was so good on Netflix.
That's the one I still haven't caught up with. I have to watch that.
Yes, definitely make time for that one. What have you been watching? What do you think I should see?
Well, you know, I watched a television program. I watched the series Ted Lasso, starring Jason Sudeikis, because, you know, I grew up in Kansas City, so there's a lot of references to Kansas City in the show, and I really got a kick out of some of those little Easter eggs in there.
Well, you know, we're going to have Jason on this podcast, so if you have any questions that you want answered, be sure to let me know.
I will.
I know that this probably won't mean anything to you, but I've been watching Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, and, you know, I'm just saying that is some of the best television in December that you will see.
I've heard mixed things. Some people seem to really like the Salt Lake City version, and some people seem down on it.
Well, I just don't feel like anywhere else in television you will get a line quite like "you smell like hospital." It's just, you know, you won't find that anywhere else.
Well, since I'm not actually traveling to Utah for the Sundance Film Festival this year in 2021, I may watch it just to get a little taste of Utah life.
Yeah, get your fur, like, ski caps and everything ready and just dive in. It's really good.
And, of course, I'm looking forward to being back here with you for our next episode of On. And now, remind me, who are you talking to this time?
Well, next episode, I sit down with Anya Taylor-Joy from The Queen's Gambit, who is just having such a moment right now. So it was a real thrill to get to talk with her.
The bit that I'm most proud of is the speed chess on the three different boards. I don't know how I did it. I don't know if I could do it again, but I did it when it counted, and I was very proud.
That conversation with Anya is coming up in episode 3 of this podcast.
The Envelope, the podcast, is hosted and reported by me, Yvonne Villarreal, and by my colleague, Mark Olson.
Our producers are Paige Heimson and Shannon Lynn, and our executive producer is Abby Fentress Swanson.
Our audio engineer is Mike Heflin, who's also responsible for our stellar theme song. If you like The Envelope, the podcast, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts and leave us a 5-star review on Apple. It really does help.
The Envelope is created by the journalists at the LA Times. Right now, access to facts has never been more important. and the Times is in the business of reporting them. Stay connected and subscribe, because your subscription supports the production of podcasts like this one and our award-winning journalism. Visit latimes.com/supportlatimes to subscribe.
Thanks for listening, and see you next time.